This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Irving Berlin wrote so many contagious songs that early on in his career, there were rumors that his songs were ghostwritten by black boys. Berlin wrote catchy songs like Alexander's Ragtime Band, Puttin' on the Ritz, and I Love a Piano, anthems like God Bless America, White Christmas, and Easter Parade, ballads like How Deep Is the Ocean and What'll I Do, waltzes like Always, cheerful songs like Isn't It a Lovely Day, and brooding songs like Let's Face the Music and Dance. My guest Lawrence Berggren started a biography of Berlin a couple of years before Berlin died in 1989 at the age of 101. He had become a recluse, estranged from family and friends. It had been 30 years since he spoke to the press. He wouldn't authorize Berggren's biography or grant him an interview, but Berggren did speak to over 200 of Berlin's friends and colleagues. Berggren is also the author of a biography of James Agee. The music industry was very different when Irving Berlin started writing songs at the beginning of the century. I asked Berggren what the place of the songwriter was then.
Well, the songwriter was far more important than he is today. There was Tin Pan Alley. That was on West 28th Street in Manhattan. There was no Hollywood. There was no radio. There were no phonographs or only very primitive home recording devices. So the songwriter and sheet music and music publishing was all of those popular entertainment industries rolled up into one. Tin Pan Alley was originally intended to become the providence of immigrant groups arriving in New York, first the Irish and later on the Eastern European Jews, of whom Irving Berlin was one. Of course, his real name was Israel Berlin. He was the son of a cantor and had come over to this country when he was five. So to become a songwriter was instantly to place yourself in the mainstream of American popular culture.
Okay, so these were the days before radio, before records.
Right.
There was sheet music. How were songs sold?
Songs were sold in department stores, such as Woolworth's especially, and other big chains. They were sold in music stores. The home entertainment center wasn't a television or a radio. It was the piano. Getting a piano was a great big event, and composers inevitably composed their songs to be performed on the piano. And it meant that it was a much more participatory form of popular entertainment. Today, we're used to being completely passive, to listening. But if you wanted to have popular entertainment in your home at that time, someone had to play the piano at least a little bit, and someone had to sing along.
Now, Irving Berlin got his start as a song plugger. What did that mean?
Well, what that meant was he plugged other people's songs. He worked in vaudeville theaters, and when it was time for a song to come around, he would stand up in the crowd and, as if spontaneously, although he wasn't fooling anybody, he would sing out the chorus and try and get the audience to sing along with him. It was sort of the equivalent of an opera claque.
And this would make the song seem really contagious, so people would want to run out and buy the sheet music.
It was like being a cheerleader, yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, songs were usually owned by the publisher at that time, but when Irving Berlin started writing songs, he eventually started publishing them himself. He must have been very savvy about this.
He was always a very savvy and very careful businessman. This was part of the reason for his success. It wasn't just musical genius. There were a few songwriters, such as Harry von Tilzer, who was an early mentor of his, who made the leap from being a humble songwriter to being a publisher, an entrepreneur, and they made far more as a publisher than they ever did as a songwriter, just getting a pittance. Berlin was keenly aware of the example of Stephen Foster, whom he considered the great American songwriter, who died virtually penniless. And Berlin was determined not to repeat that example in his own life. So as soon as he was able to, he started his own music publishing company to control his copyrights and royalties and to publish his own songs. He also published songs by other songwriters as well, and what was then known as race music or black music. There was a special division for that.
My guest is Lawrence Berggren, and he's written a new biography of Irving Berlin. Let's get to one of Berlin's songs. This is the song that established him. It's the first song that was a hit, and it was called My Wife's Gone to the Country. Would you like to say something about this song?
Berlin had great affection for this song because it was his first big hit. It was even before, it was a year before Alexander's Ragtime Band in 1910. And the idea came to him when he walked into a barber shop one night and he heard a friend of his exclaiming with delight that his wife had gone away to the country for the summer, leaving him alone to frolic in the city by himself. Berlin thought this was a great idea for a chorus, My Wife's Gone to the Country, and wrote the song. And it was so popular that a newspaper asked him to write some extra verses for it, which presumably probably don't appear on your recording. He went and wrote 200 extra, just to give an idea of the fertility of his mind and the rapidity of his the way he worked. He was a very hard worker.
Well, we've got a 1910 recording of My Wife's Gone to the Country featuring Harry Carlton and his orchestra.
I just can't stand the heat. Please send me to the country, dear, I know it would be a treat. Next day his wife and family were seated on a train, and when the train had started, Brownie shouted this refrain: my wife's gone to the country, hurrah, hurrah. She thought it best I need a rest, that's why she went away. She took the children with her, hurrah, hurrah. I don't care what becomes of me, my wife's gone away. My wife's gone to the country. Oh, I am going to enjoy myself.
Lawrence Bergen, why do you think that was such a hit?
Well, I think it struck a nerve. It had a risque overtone to it, and many men could relate to it instantly. It was comic, and it was a novelty song. It was published just before the summer was coming up in the spring, and people went out and got it, and it became a hit song for the summer of 1910.
Just to give a sense of the money, this was before Irving Berlin was publishing his own songs, and you say he made $6,000 from this song.
That's right.
And his publisher made $30,000.
That's right. He was earning just a couple of cents per copy himself, and when he realized how much his publisher was making, he decided he had to become a publisher himself eventually.
Now, Irving Berlin really knew how to tie into the times, and a great early example of that is how he tied into the ragtime craze.
Yes, of course, ragtime had peaked slightly before he came along, and it was mainly black musicians. There were a few white ragtime artists as well. The craze was dying out, and then he revived it by bringing it into the mainstream and adapting it to a Tin Pan Alley formula. Of course, one of the peculiar things about Alexander's ragtime band is that it's not a ragtime song. It's not written in ragtime. There's only a little bit of ragtime in it. What made the song sell was using that buzzword, ragtime, in the title. It's actually a march.
Well, you say Alexander's ragtime band was really a march. Now, I'd like to play a kind of very march-like version of it, recorded in 1911, a year after the song was written. And then let's contrast that to another version sung by Bessie Smith. That's Bessie Smith, and before that we heard the Victor Military Band. I think that really gives a nice sense of how flexible his songs were.
That Bessie Smith, she always sends chills up and down my spine. She's fabulous. Of course, he wrote that song first as an instrumental, and it flopped. And he shelved it for a while, and he wrote some lyrics for it and tried it again, and then it caught on, not in New York where most of these songs did, but in Chicago where Emma Carris sang it, and then it worked its way back east gradually.
Well, we were talking about a time before radio, when Berlin was writing songs. What was the effect of radio and the rise in the popularity of recordings on his career?
Well, it helped him, but he dreaded its arrival. He was always very conservative in his approach. He felt that radio would eat up his catalog and wear out his songs. He preferred the slower distribution method of sheet music. But what happened in his case was he wrote what was then a number of what was then called sob songs, such as All Alone. And these were picked up by the radio, and they became hugely popular, which sparked sheet music sales and which sparked early recordings as well. So he benefited from a triple play. But some of his concern came to pass for other songwriters or other parts of his business.
Berlin started writing for movies, and you say this was at a time when Tin Pan Alley basically sold out to the Hollywood studios. The studio actually bought a lot of the music publishing companies?
That's right. Well, it was the Depression coming, and what happened was many of the Tin Pan Alley publishers, which had grown very quickly during the teens and 20s, found themselves overextended, short of cash. It's a familiar story, and the Hollywood studios, which were then just beginning to blossom, came along, and of course they needed music for the talkies. And they began buying first the songs, then they decided to buy the companies as well. Almost all of them were bought up. Tin Pan Alley became an adjunct of Hollywood, and West 28th Street was quiet. There was only one major music publisher who was a holdout, and that was Irving Berlin, Inc.
Why did he hold out?
That was the strength of Berlin's character. He wanted to stand alone. He wanted control over his musical destiny and over himself. He had nothing else he could rely on. He was used to relying on his own wits to survive. And he felt if he could only ride out the Depression, then his copyrights, the value of them, the musical copyrights, which were then depressed, would eventually go up.
Well, I'm sure he was right about that.
Yes.
Well, even though he didn't sell out his company, he did do a lot of work for Hollywood.
Yes. Oh, yes, he did. He was eager to write for films. It took him years to break in, though. He had one flop after another. First, there were songs such as Marie that were used in silence. Then he began writing scores. His first major effort was a movie called Puttin' on the Ritz, which was the centerpiece, of course, was the wonderful song Puttin' on the Ritz. This starred the vaudevillian Harry Richmond. However, it was a terrible movie, and it flopped. It wasn't until Top Hat, with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, his score for that, which contained the fabulous Cheek to Cheek, that he really scored. And no one forgot all the earlier tentative efforts of his. And from then on, his name was gold in Hollywood.
How were Berlin and Astaire put together in a movie?
Well, they were put together by the producer, Pandro S. Berman, who had fabulous taste. He told me that he had been dying to put these two together. And also, Berlin and Astaire had a great deal in common. They had both come up through vaudeville, and they were both highly dedicated and intense perfectionists. So I think the high standards that they set for themselves allowed them to have a very good working relationship.
Well, let's hear one of the really beautiful songs from the movie Top Hat. And this is Cheek to Cheek, sung by Fred Astaire, recorded in 1935.
Heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak. And I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Heaven, I'm in heaven, and the cares that hung around me through the week seem to vanish like a gambler's lucky streak when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love to climb a mountain and to reach the highest peak.
Gosh, I love that. you say that Irving Berlin said that he'd rather have Fred Astaire introduce a song than any other singer.
Yes, that's right.
I can certainly understand why.
Well, he loved the way that Astaire kind of combined singing and speaking at the same time. He put a little jaunty hopping rhythm in there, and Berlin felt he had extraordinary sensitivity to his music.
Would you tell the story of how Moss Hart once reacted when he had Irving Berlin demonstrate one of his new songs?
I'd be glad to. This was something that happened to Berlin throughout his career. Like many songwriters, Berlin was a terrible performer. His voice was high. It was reedy. You would have to say this in his favor, though. He had absolutely perfect pitch. However, when he sang one of his songs, they sounded terrible. When he was writing the score for his famous review of called As Thousands Cheer in 1932, from which I took the title of my book, in 1933, rather, he began to sing some of the songs, such as Heat Wave, for Moss Hart, who was appalled. Here was the great Irving Berlin, and he was sitting at the piano and singing, and Hart thought the songs sounded tinny, they sounded empty, they sounded like nothing. He got very, very worried. Hart was a worrywart. Finally, he said, "Irving, would you please sing Cheek to Cheek, or All Alone, or several other of his classics?" And Berlin sang the others, and they sounded just as terrible, and Hart found that very reassuring, that he knew he had some hit songs on his hands, as soon as he could get them to real performers.
Well, not only couldn't Berlin sing very well, he wasn't a very convincing pianist either.
Well, no, that was one of the things that intrigued me about him, was the paradox of our nation's greatest and most successful songwriter being unable to read or write music. And I think that that was an astonishing story. He used a couple of ways of getting around this limitation. And one was the use of a musical secretary who took down the notation for him. The other was the use of a prepared piano, which could shift keys at the touch of a lever, which was a fairly common invention when Berlin was a young man. And whenever he did try to take formal music lessons or piano lessons, he tried several times, it was a disaster. And it made him feel self-conscious and got in the way of his composing. And finally, people would tell him, "Irving, just stick with doing it the way you're doing."
Lawrence Berggren is my guest, and he's written a new biography of Irving Berlin called As Thousands Cheer. Let's get Irving Berlin back from movies to Broadway. One of Berlin's most famous, most celebrated musicals was the 1946 Annie, Get Your Gun. Berlin wasn't supposed to be the composer who wrote this.
That's right. He was not the first choice. It was Jerome Kern who was supposed to write this. Rodgers and Hammerstein, who were much better known for South Pacific, were then becoming producers as well, and they wanted Kern to write it. Kern somewhat reluctantly came back to New York from Hollywood to begin work on the score, and he suddenly collapsed on the pavement of Manhattan and died several days later. Afterwards, the backers of the show began scrambling for someone else who would be American enough to write the story of this unlettered sharpshooter, inevitably, they settled on Berlin. Of course, Berlin was known not only as a brilliant songwriter, but as a giant ego, and they were afraid they might have to turn over the show lock, stock, and barrel to him, which they weren't prepared to do. Berlin gave ground a little bit and stopped insisting on having his name in the title as Irving Berlin's Annie, Get Your Gun, and to write a traditional score. And it was his most successful score. It was filled with one hit after another. I've Got the Sun in the Morning and the Moon at Night, There's No Business Like Show Business, and six or seven others.
It's amazing in a way that show business greatest anthem, There's No Business Like Show Business, came from a musical about Annie Oakley.
That's right. We tend to think of that song now as being very bombastic and very self-celebrating, but in the context of the original show where it appeared, there was just a small group of three or four performers who sang it. It was slightly poignant. It was almost a self-parody, and it didn't have that larger-than-life quality that we tend to find intimidating today, and that made it a far more charming song, I think, in its original incarnation.
Why don't we hear it?
The cowboys, the wrestlers, the tumblers, the clowns, the roustabouts that move the show at dawn. The music, the spotlights, the people, the towns, your baggage with the labels pasted on. The sawdust and the horses and the smell. The towel you've taken from the last hotel. There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing, everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show.
There's no business like show business. From the cast recording of the 1966 revival of Annie, Get Your Gun. Irving Berlin's career kind of headed downwards after this musical, didn't it?
Well, by then he was getting older. Of course, even in his late 50s, he had managed to hang on far longer than most songwriters, who often burned out when they were very young indeed in their 20s. So already he had an extraordinary track record. His songs were still good in Hollywood. He had one or two more successes on Broadway, especially Call Me Madam, which also starred Ethel Merman a few years later. But it's true, then he began losing his self-confidence, losing his touch, and unfortunately the forces which gradually overtook him were beginning to form.
Well, you describe him as something of a reactionary, too, especially in his reaction to Elvis Presley's White Christmas. Why don't you describe his response?
Well, he was horrified by it, and as soon as he heard it, he sent telegrams around to all the radio stations in the country forbidding them from performing this song. And, of course, he was appalled by the rise of rock and roll and phenomena such as Elvis Presley, not so much on a political basis, but because he saw his livelihood being taken away by a new breed of performer who placed themselves above the song and who had an entirely different audience. Berlin had managed to reinvent himself for several generations throughout the teens, the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s. But in the 60s, he saw that it was going to be impossible to reinvent himself for the kids, the youth of that time.
Was he bitter about that?
Extremely bitter, yes.
Well, we've only had time to talk about a really small part of Irving Berlin's life and songs. But I thank you very much for bringing that small part to life for us. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Terry.
My guest has been Lawrence Berggren, and he's written a new biography of Irving Berlin called As Thousands Cheer. It's just been published by Viking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.